Today's talk is given by Dr. Tim Mathis of Australia's Commonwealth Scientific Research Organisation, or CSIRO. His talk is entitled Earth Observation Perspectives Over a Large Dry Flat Continent. And Tim heads the Environmental Observation Group at CSIRO and combines skills in calibration, validation and field spectroscopy with analysis of airborne and satellite Earth observation data. Prior to joining CSIRO, Tim was director of the NERC field spectroscopy facility here, based at the University of Edinburgh, and in 2009 was the head of the Edinburgh Earth Observatory. And Tim and I also both served our time on our undergraduate field trip to Bangor in North Wales and enjoyed marking many a GIS dissertation in the comfort and warmth of that relative comfort of the van while the intrepid students sampled various things outside. And that's enough from me, so I'll hand over to Tim Mathis.
Great, thank you. Hi everybody, yeah, very great to be back. So it's only for a couple of days, it's very fleeting, but I'll be back in April next year for much, much longer. What I'd like to talk about today is, give or take a sort of flippant title, it's not so much research that I've undertaken, but it's research in this group of about 30 individuals in this Environmental Earth Observation program within the Division of Land and Water that I essentially had the pleasure of leading. And so the work that I report on here is really the efforts of particularly Albert van Dijk and Luigi Rizzullo, with contributions from the other three individuals here. I'm just the mouthpiece for some really interesting stuff. But what I thought would be useful is actually to talk about a country where, you know, Earth observation plays a critical role in input in terms of, it's a continent with significant issues, particularly around the issue of water, and Earth observation can play a key role in this, in understanding water and in forecasting water availability in particular at the sort of continental scale, and that's the sort of perspective for which I am coming from. CSIRO, I guess, demarcating its research from what is contributed by Australian universities, really has a kind of, on the environmental science side, I guess, really has a national sort of focus, continental focus, and perhaps is the only organisation in Australia that could deliver that national focus. So a bit of context and motivation for the talk and for motivation for what follows, a bit of sort of proper history or recent update on history of droughts, etc. How then those challenges are being laid down there are being met, in particular as a water information research and development alliance, and talk about model data fusion, and then I want to introduce this model, the Australian Water Resources Assessment Model, which integrates Earth observation into it and shows some evaluations, so that we're well on the path to developing an accounting system for water in Australia. Talk about a sort of precipitation product which feeds into that, and then what I'd like to round up with then is perhaps moving away from that, but another example of a product, of a MODIS-based product, just to show you its development for estimating fractional vegetation cover across the continent as well. And then really to explore some sort of issues, some other issues in the conclusions. So, in terms of a bit of context, you're all probably pretty aware that Australia underwent a significant drought, and it sort of argues over how long it actually lasted, but over the last 10 to 15 years, that drought in the east coast of Australia is broken. It still actually is not broken in the western Australia in particular, but it's led to significant discussions about water consumption. Water use for irrigation, significant impacts of that drought on farming, in particular that crop yields, etc., were significantly low, and things like that. In 2007, then, this is the sort of latter years of the John Howard Prime Ministership, there was passed the Water Act, a federal act by the federal government, and that essentially did two key things, lots of other things, but two key things. It essentially charged the Bureau of Meteorology, the equivalent of the UK Met Office for Australia, to develop a continental water accounting system. So they gave them $500 million dollars to set up essentially a water branch to develop, essentially, much like weather forecasts, to begin actually getting the information to actually establish a national water account for Australia, and then to actually ultimately produce forecasts of availabilities, much like a sort of weather forecast from days to decades. That legislation also kicked in a federal takeover of the Murray-Darling Basin system. I'll talk about that in the next couple of slides, introduce it, basically. So a large basin that runs through four states, and essentially the federal government took over its management. Okay, and the key reason for doing that was to set new limits on water that could be taken from the basin. So those are the sort of those are the key background in terms of the Water Act. There's also a significant discussion going on, I guess, in Australia over this notion of Big Australia. The former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd was very keen on expanding the population from the present sort of took roughly 21 million now to by 15 million by 2050, largely through increased immigration, which has really been the key source of Australia's growth in population. But that comes with significant resourcing issues, particularly for water. I live in Canberra. Water is already a scarce resource. We live under constant restrictions on its use already. And to expand the population by 15 million represents significant further demands on water availability. This is the Australian version of the Daily Telegraph. A few weeks ago, officially announcing that the drought in New South Wales is officially over. I think this is the same family on their farm 5 years ago or something. Everything's dry and parched, and now everything's green and lush. Some CSIRO wag with the powers of Nostradamus has predicted that actually the drought's going to be back. I guess it didn't take too many brain cells to work that out, that eventually we're going to go back to the drought at some stage as well. But this was the Saturday before I came here. Interesting to note that, you know, in a sort of, albeit this is a sort of Canberra Times, secondary city or something, that CSIRO gets a mention. It just sort of shows the power of the brand in a way. It gets a mention in the main headline in the newspaper. But this was really an argument against the easing of water restrictions in Canberra itself. So in terms of this, just a little bit about the Murray-Darling River system, we could call it Australia's Mississippi or something like that. It covers essentially 23 major river valleys, a catchment over a million square kilometres. One of the largest and driest catchments in the world, considerable number of wetlands, ephemeral wetlands there, home to 2 million people, and fundamental for Australia's agricultural production. So it produces 39% of Australia's agricultural production, worth $15 billion per year. Contains a significant amount of irrigated land, and it's a lot of extraction from the water system itself to produce those crops, but also then significant water quality problems as well. So it's not a problem of only water quantity, it's a problem of water quality. And the federal takeover, largely because of the lack of water that occurred during the drought, was that really there was just significant over-abstraction of the water for irrigation, largely due to oversubscription of water rights to the river. So the federal government has been buying back water rights, essentially, to address it, try and rebalance the system. So a bit of a map. So we had the east coast of Australia, here, Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, here, and we have the Darling system starting up in South Queensland. This is the border of Queensland and New South Wales here. And then we've got the Victorian border roughly down here and South Australia here. So we've got this river system covering four states, consisting of the Darling system all up here and then the Murray system feeding in Victoria and lower New South Wales, all ending up in South Australia, where it actually flows into the sea. But we have, significant, the green patches are significant areas of irrigation, particularly in the sort of Murrumbidgee catchment, to the west of Canberra, particularly in Victoria, and then up into Queensland as well. Shows you also the significance of the sort of ephemeral wetlands that occur along the river channel and certainly in, in inland areas of Queensland. And these are only recently sort of flushing green for the first time in a number of years as a result of significant amounts of rainfall. A huge system, incredibly flat. The rainfall that occurred in February up here caused flooding in inland Queensland. In February, by June, had kind of reached somewhere down here, down towards the Victorian border. It takes that long for the water to flow through the system. This is just an illustration of the flows down in South Australia. This is the river mouth itself, which for the last 5 years there has been no net flow from the Murray-Darling system into the sea. It's been the opposite. These lakes here, known as the Coorong Lakes, are becoming hypersaline simply as a result of saltwater intrusion, because there simply has been no water at the outflow. It's all been taken before it's got there. And so, significant issues with South Australia moaning that the other states, of course, are feathering their own nests, abstracting all the water. By the time things get to South Australia, there's no water left for farmers there. So it was really right for a federal takeover to better manage the system. So they set up the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, and that is charged with essentially coming up with a plan for water use in the basin. And on the 8th of October this year, they released to a guide to the plan. Essentially, they sort of said, well, this is how we're going to do it, but this isn't the plan. And this just really waded into a storm of controversy, particularly with irrigators and farmers. They were largely arguing in the guide to the plan, and it's quite a thick thing, several hundred pages thick. It was really arguing for increased allocations for the river itself, for environmental flows and concomitantly less abstraction for irrigators. And there's been huge protests and quite a lot of the rural towns have been, copies of this have been burnt ceremoniously in piles and things like that, and tires and all sorts. And it's led to quite a significant reaction and some sort of reaction from the government as well to calm things down. So if that wasn't evidence enough, you know, and more questions about why do we need a continental water information system in Australia now? And really, it's really to answer some of these questions, some of the questions that we ask. We want to know how much water, you know, has been added to the system as a result of some event, how much has been taken, how much is left, who's using the water, are they entitled to it, how and why has the water situation changed? Answer many, many questions about sort of water availability, you could say. Then that leads into sort of, if we're actually going to be able to answer those questions, then we then need reliable estimates of all of the water budget terms, or all the terms of water budget. Water in the soil, groundwater, rivers, lakes, dams, then precipitation. Water use by agriculture, by forestry, etc., etc., mining, industry, households, all of those sorts of things. Water loss is due to inefficiencies, evaporation, and that's a significant component of the Murray-Darling water budget. And as I said, we need to know inputs from precipitation. But the sort of Water Act has really charged the Bureau with coming up with essentially this kind of not just the Murray-Darling system, but this kind of system that works nationally, but actually needs to have credibility at the local scale. Otherwise, people are just not going to believe it. So it needs to be locally credible and have relevance. Then, be the best possible quality, minimise uncertainty, let's say, and it needs to be near real time. You can't have things that are really. That are offering predictions far too late in the day. So why is this information not already there? And I would argue, as my colleague has done quite successfully in a number of papers, that really there is no, there's only really one water resources management model in the world at the present, and that's one that only started in 2009 in the Netherlands. It's called the Netherlands, didn't get the name right, Netherlands Hydrological Modelling Instrument, or NMHI. So really, although there are plenty of water models, there's a great record of them from hydrologists developed here like Keith Bevan and Howard Winter and others around the country here in the UK, and also from CEH, I guess, but And I guess there are also then hydrological models, well-developed hydrological models that feed into the land surface components of global climate models, but there really isn't any models that actually exist there for water resource management. And the reason for why it never occurred in Australia is that really the previous crises were mostly local and in the domain of state agencies. So now there's a much more national focus. I guess there was a national focus to the drought, but also a national focus in terms of management of some of those systems. Too much research focused on scenario and design questions about, you know, we can put a weir on the system to extract water from it, etc. Not so much on resource monitoring. We have a significant problem in Australia, and this just shows the two examples of the rainfall gauge network in Australia, and we have surface groundwater and surface and groundwater gauging network. The groundwater ones are the ones in pink, surface gauging stations in blue on that bottom graph. That they're very sparse. Significant amounts of Australia just simply not covered in groundwater observation. So we don't have the complete information of the situation on the ground itself. And then run by numerous different organisations, the Bureau itself, irrigators, farming organisations, farming agencies, etc., etc. I think also you could argue that Earth observation in the context of hydrological modelling was also, or the use of it was very immature as well, and that has been developing. And that the two, the modelling and the observation, have really been treated quite separately, and if incorporated, only used for recalibration. So I have to keep an eye on the time here. Okay. So it was really felt then, I guess, a couple of years ago when all this kicked off, that we're at a point where perhaps we can begin to address this challenge. And in Australia, there were a few pathways. The notion of the Water Act setting up and charging the Bureau of Meteorology with management and the tools, the resources to actually collate all relevant observations to deliver information services for water itself. We've then seen, I guess, the maturing of Earth observation analysis and data analysis and applications such that we can get to a state where we can actually perhaps monitor surface water better. And we've also seen in that time then advances in combining models and observations through model data fusion. And so then a research alliance has been set up between CSIRO, partly funded by CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology, called WRADA, which is really looking at developing these tools, a tool for improved continental scale water accounting. If you want to find out more about it, if you just put WRADA in Google, you'll find lots about it. It has four components. I don't want to dwell on this. The key ones I just want to touch on vaguely here are sort of the foundation data. So they're significantly, they've put a lot of money into improving the terrain, the digital elevation model for Australia, based on SRTM. But components, I guess, of our group have fed into improve precipitation and rapid transpiration products. And then item three is essentially the development of this model, this AURA model, the water resource assessment, and accounting. So those are the two bits I want to sort of focus on here. But you can see it sort of goes, I guess, from the notion of informatics, of sort of tools, I guess these are the development of tools, transfer standards, workbench, etc., feeding in through to a sort of forecasting system at the end. So then this introduces then the development within, this is largely by Albert van Dijk, of this Australian water resources assessment model. So the aim here is to really start off simply, and the notion of starting simply and getting complicated later, and is to try and reconstruct, as it says here, the entire water balance for the whole of Australia, hopefully with an accuracy acceptable for water resource management. But at its outset, it relies then on a combination of inputs from ground-based measurement and also satellite information in the form of a number of different products. Key specifications is continental coverage, this notion of being locally accurate and relevant, up to date, so near real time, and this key one of integrating ground and satellite observations from the outset. So it consists of four components, four models: a water use model, landscape model, river model, groundwater model. The one I want to sort of focus on is really the inputs that our group is sort of fed into, is really into the landscape model. But we can see feeding into this essentially is some limited information from water use metering, surface water monitoring, groundwater monitoring, satellite estimates of evapotranspiration feeding into the water use model. But then we also have blended precipitation satellite products feeding into this landscape model. And the satellite products here are largely sort of vegetation focused. So the whole notion really of this kind of model is this issue of what we can call model data fusion, where we have a set of on-ground observations being relatively direct, but as we saw from those previous maps, being quite sparse and perhaps also being infrequent and not having on their own any predictive capability. We then also have satellite observations. They give us the spatial coverage, and they give us that spatial coverage quite frequently. Relatively indirect, though, we perhaps use certain some sort of spectral index or something to infer something about vegetation properties or about soil moisture or something like that. And again, not predictive. We then have biophysical models. Glass. That allow that predictive capability. We can directly interpret them by tweaking various factors, etc. We can build them so that they can provide full and continuous coverage, but wonderfully, let's say, unhindered by reality. And the whole aim then is to perhaps hook up these on-ground observations, the satellite observations, through this notion of data fusion, to then use the power of the models to then more accurately estimate water, to account for the water and to predict future states of water. So what we then have, I've got a little less configuring, I think. In this landscape hydrological model then, is a number of observations from conventional met stations and from thermal and vegetation sensors feeding into essentially an estimate of evaporative energy or evapotranspiration. We have satellite observations of land cover and vegetation amount, located through either the NDVI index or EVI, Enhanced Vegetation Index. We then have a blended product of ground and earth observations of precipitation. More about that in a few slides' time. So the land cover feeds into vegetation amount. From that, we're also then helping estimate evapotranspiration that's feeding in here, precipitation feeding in into the model that then predicts essentially what might consist in different components, surface water, groundwater, what penetrates deeply, etc. That links up then with the river model and the aquifer models. And all this has been put together relatively quickly. And I'm amazed by its success, which is illustrated in one example here. So this is an example of the output of the Aura model, and this is simply only version. This is not the version. The model hasn't been released yet, so it's only version 0.5. But this is a comparison to what we can call unimpaired catchments. So these are catchments for which there are no known extractions of water. I stress known abstractions. I suspect there's a lot of illegal abstraction goes on. But here, essentially, the correlation between recorded stream flow on those catchments, and they're shown by these green dots on the map here, and then that estimated from the model itself. And you can see that the agreement is pretty good. The agreement is virtually one-to-one. So there's no bias in the estimates from the model. Without actually having performed an optimization. Relative and absolute agreement for the years means as good or better than 20% than achieved using previous models. And this would suggest then it's suitable for some kind, you know, this model is suitable for accounting and assessment. And this gives you an example of the model outputs in blue versus actual measures down the stream flow at just one gauge. Don't ask me where that is. But you can see that the agreement is relatively good. This year there are much more formal benchmarking going on underway to actually ascertain more significant uncertainties in this approach. A second example of validation of the Aura model is provided through the GRACE Earth observation satellites, the GRACE stands for Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment. It measures the gravity anomaly globally. One thing that then that anomaly can be, or what can drive that anomaly, is essentially total terrestrial water storage. And there was a really good paper in Nature about 6 to 8 months ago showing that application in the north of India. I think it was from a group at NASA. But we can also use GRACE information over Australia to then also estimate total, to look at then total water storage in the Australian system. So this essentially represents the model outputs, or just one example of model outputs for total water storage from the Aura model, this map, and then we can then compare it to different regions. So this is comparing it to the up towards Darwin way, so let's say tropical with a distinct rainfall season area, and the model is in blue, and the grace estimated total water storage is in brown. And you can see that the agreement is pretty remarkable that the model and GRACE are agreed quite well. It also says that you could use GRACE quite accurately to estimate total water storage in Australia too. Just for different systems, so we're here down in northern New South Wales, so a much more irregular system. Rainfall happens when it happens. There's no real sort of seasonality to it, let's say. And you can see that, there are sort of wider differences here, but there's generally pretty good agreement between the two. For such a simple model. And again here, these are catchments, not states, so these were down in South Australia here, I think, and we can see then, again, very good agreement between the two for this area. So this gives us significant confidence that this model that we have, this team has actually developed a model that is highly useful for water accounting and water resource management. So then, what can we actually use that for? And this might then be some examples of what the Bureau of Meteorology might actually produce. So one example is a report, let's say, on current total water storage. And this is an estimate output from the model for the 1st of February 2010. So it compares essentially total water storage as an anomaly compared to the average for the day over the sort of 1980 to 2008 period. So it shows that on the 1st of February there's significant water storage compared to the normal in the northern regions, and then much lower, let's say, in the southeastern regions and also southwestern Australia. If you sort of blow up this region here, that gives you an idea of the sort of resolution of the report. So it's I would argue, you know, this is a significant advance in being able to monitor, I guess, at a continental scale, water resources. Some further examples and trends. What can be also output the model is then an indication of trends in some of these factors. And these are sort of some of the interesting things that actually come out of the analysis of some of the data that's gone into Aura. That actually over the period of 1980 to 2008, and this is using a combination of ground-based and satellite-based observations, that actually for large parts of Australia, there wasn't a drought, but actually rainfall increased, particularly sort of in the inland and in the desert regions and in the north of the country. That data is also supported by then estimates of stream flow. In fact, you know, over that period, stream flow increased across northern Australia. And has interestingly prompted arguments that, well, maybe we should shift some of the agriculture that occurs here into making a new bread basket, let's say, up here, but others don't seem to think that's going to happen. And again, that information is then further supported by changes in vegetation greenness across that period of time here, where we find actually there's been, let's call it a blooming of the desert or something like that. It hasn't gone blue, but it's sort of partly green, I should say, and maybe then a significant reduction in vegetation greenness in that sort of, particularly in that Murray-Darling catchment system, where the drought has particularly been strong. So I just wanted to talk briefly about one of the aspects of this, and again an example of I guess model data fusion, is this notion of blended rain gauge information with satellite precipitation products to derive a new product for estimates of rainfall across Australia. And again, the argument for doing this is largely based on this map, that actually our observations are incomplete, that we don't have a full spatial cover from the ground-based observation network, and that we actually could do with the estimates, the high temporal frequency of estimates provided by things like the TRIM multi-satellite precipitation analysis. Okay, so this just shows you the general product here. We can extract the Australian data set, and then TRIM can be used to provide daily rainfall estimates. We can also then, if we wanted to, spatially interpret the data from this to also arrive at a daily estimate for rainfall for Australia. But one would argue, perhaps naturally, that perhaps we can fill in the gaps in this observation network using the satellite observations here to derive a sort of blended satellite gauge gradient rainfall estimate. And that's essentially what Luigi Renzullo in the group has been doing. So these are sequences of daily rainfall from March 2010. We have the blend in the middle. This is the rain gauge. This is the estimates from the interpolated rain gauge information. The estimates from TRIM itself. And then this is the sort of blended product in the middle. And you can see what there is some validation. Essentially, there's validation sort of going on now to actually assess the accuracy. But certainly, what we have is that we've certainly improved the accuracy in the areas where the rain gauge network is very sparse. It has some issues. It's not very real time at the moment, so there is a 12-hour latency on the product. And we could actually explore other data products. Precipitation products. There's not just TRIM out there, but there are these other ones as well. And perhaps needs an objective quantitative assessment of accuracy. And this is perhaps one of the key challenges we have, actually, is actually validating, really truly quantitatively validating these products. So that's one example. That's the sort of AURA system and systems for accounting. For the last part of the talk, I just wanted to sort of highlight, sort of move away from water, let's say, to highlight another continental product, which is this notion of fractional cover. A very simple but effective product, which is again undergoing a bit of a validation. Fractional cover, fractional vegetation cover is critical, and is a critical information requirement for Australia, simply because again, we need to estimate vegetation amount in terms of water use, as I've just been talking about, but also fractional cover in terms of the impact then of water and wind and water erosion, in particular wind erosion. There also needs significant, as a result of the drought, significant funding for farmers to actually better manage their properties, and we need a tool that actually can monitor the effectiveness of that management. So we can ask the question, well, is the fractional cover of vegetation increasing? Is the bare soil component decreasing? There's been a lot of previous work done in Australia, but it really focused on the tree and grass proportions and ignored what we could call that non-photosynthetic component, that bit that is dry grass during most of the year. But actually is critically important in the whole process, particularly because it's huge shocks of carbon. It's not always brown, it's also green. Significant, as it poses a significant fire risk if there's lots of it. But it represents a ground cover, it does prevent erosion. And perhaps also information for grazing management as well. Critical examples of those, just an example of the MODIS image at the time of the February 2009 Black Saturday Victorian bushfires, which killed over 100 people. And again, the dry fuel component or non-photosynthetic component of the forest, of the grasslands, is a critical factor in fire and the heat they generate. The other one then is the examples you saw in September 2009 last year. I'm sure you saw images of that over here as well of the big blow, they call it. So essentially high winds whipping up soil, essentially the soil fracturing from the desert and then sweeping them across cities, and we saw these amazing examples of Sydney in the daytime coated in red dust. So significant wind erosion problem. And of course, when it impacts on cities, then money starts to flow. So this led one professor, Gershman, to address this issue by taking some results of some American research and adapting it to the Australian example. And we just look at three sets of high-resolution spectra here. One for green vegetation, brown vegetation, and bare soil. We know that photosynthetic vegetation is easily differentiable because of this distinctive red edge. So a ratio of some sort of near-infrared to red wavelength helps us distinguish what's green vegetation. Non-photosynthetic vegetation also has significant features simply due to what we could call biochemistry particularly up in these wavelengths, which are simply due to components of the cellulose and lignin in the plant tissue. So even though there isn't any green biomass and there's not much water and not much pigment, there are telltale signals, let's say, for whether that reflected spectrum is from vegetation or not. And then bare soil doesn't have any of those two indices. So that you could then easily argue that actually you could quantify then those three components simply on the basis of two indices. And that's kind of what this product is derived from. So that if you actually plot feature space comparison of the normalized difference vegetation index versus the cellulose absorption index, which is based, I should say, sorry, on those two high, on three, I think, in the middle infrared, square wavelengths. What we then find is actually things plot out in a kind of feature space in a kind of triangle to which the sort of apices of the triangle represent the different fractions of cover. So we have bare soil low down on both indices, non-photosynthetic vegetation high on cellulose absorption but low on NDVI, and then we have green vegetation plotting out here. So we get this sort of triangle, pixels plotting out in that shape. And the points of the triangle perhaps represent the end members in some sort of unmixing of these three components. Then that has been verified. This is from data from 2005 for the Northern Territory, not actually acquired directly for this analysis, but based on another transect. But essentially, it was the measurement of ground spectra of these different components. And lo and behold, what you do find in the real data at ground level is that this plot of this triangle occurs. Bare soil dominated, non-photosynthetic, or brown vegetation, green vegetation. We can then compare that over exactly the same site as the Northern Territory data to the Hyperion data. So Hyperion is hyperspectral, fully hyperspectral data, consisting of lots of spectral bands, so it has enough information to tell us about this, particularly this cellulose absorption index, which essentially is a sort of hyperspectral index. And then for those three, that was sort of images for 2005 from three different times of the year. And again, we get this plot out of this triangular relationship in terms of these two indices. So this gives us a great deal of confidence that, from space, we can then begin to actually map fractional cover in terms of three key components: green, brown, vegetation, and bare soil. But what the problem is, of course, Hyperion and most other hyperspectral satellites, unless Hyspera comes along in a hurry, and I don't think it's going to, only produce strips of information such as this. They're not going to give us the sort of continental cover that we'd require for Australia. So how can we actually adapt this to get this continental cover? Are we off the time? Maybe I'll skip that. Sorry. This was just an example to actually show measurements actually made at different points in time corresponding to those three Hyperion images to kind of show the trajectories that actually do occur. So each three points represents a change, a change in season, let's say, to show that most of the points measured in the field do lie within that triangle defined by the Hyperion data, and along sensible trajectories where we have a trend that transformation, let's say, from green grass in April through to non-photosynthetic vegetation in September. So we would go from this point in the triangle up here. So then, the key question is, how do we then scale this to the scale of a continent? And so what has been looked at essentially is NDVI is not a problem. We can get that from MODIS data. MODIS is the sort of key product we've used. But can we actually find what we don't have is this high spectral resolution that's required to estimate the cellulose absorption index. And so what Juan Pablo Gershman looked at was really was, well, can we have information up here in square wave bands, can we actually use this information to perhaps in a simple ratio to derive some kind of surrogate for the cellulose absorption index? And the question is, and the answer is, I guess, you can. But what you get is a kind of compressed triangle. It's not a... it's kind of moved the triangle, moved the apex of the triangle in here, I guess. So it's not as accurate, let's say, as perhaps we can do with a high spectral resolution instrument. But it gives us confidence that we still get a kind of triangle being plotted out. So that then gives us confidence that, two-weekly composite data for MODIS. We add at the continental scale for Australia, and then we can produce a fractional cover product for the continent. And that's exactly what he did. So this is a sort of mean fractional cover product. Apologize for garish colours, but 2009. This shows you the sort of colour scale in terms of the variation from brown vegetation, green, and bare soil is blue. So it's based on MODIS data collection 4 just being updated to collection 5 at the moment. So it's at a 500 meter resolution and a 16 day time step for this composites. But what you could do even is actually from this data, from this MODIS product, actually produce a daily product if you want it. The key issue here, again, is validation. But before I talk about that, I just simply want to talk about you can then begin to interrogate that information. So this is, we have, 9 years of data here, so we can sort of drill down and look at trends. And I guess that's the key value in this, that the trends can actually tell us, well, is the bare soil cover decreasing? Is the cover of vegetation increasing? Are these management practices working, and if they're working, then we should be able to reduce wind and water erosion, etc. So we're looking at, I guess, trends through the data. Yeah. And just some examples of the trends in the product, and you can see distinct. So this is from one pixel area. So we've highlighted two areas where we appear to have a decrease in soil component here and an increase in non-photosynthetic vegetation here. Here, perhaps showing, we can see definitely the seasonality in the index here, and these are just crude sort of linear trends, I guess, put on this data, but to show essentially the transformation and the change over that 9-year period in bare soil in this area, and you'd expect, I guess, this component has increased simply as a result of the drought across that period of time at the expense, while green vegetation has stayed relatively level at the expense of non-photosynthetic vegetation cover. And there's similar sorts of trends, let's say, for another area as well. What's going on now for this product is essentially a much more quantitative validation. In the paper, this comes from a paper published in Remote Sensing Environment in 2009, and this is the only validation data set that was available. So this is data collected for a fire study in different parts of Australia. The various points on the map represent the areas where the measurements were made. And it shows essentially the points themselves are the actual measurements. The lines show the motor status. So we have, I'm just trying to remember what the colours represent. So the colours must be in the same component. So green represents photosynthetic vegetation, red representing the change in non-photosynthetic vegetation. The difference being the bare soil component. And what we have then is the field measurements overlaid to show roughly that in certain areas, and these are areas all around Australia, in certain areas the product works extremely well. We have a really good agreement, say in this example here, between the MODIS product and the field validation. In other areas, there's a lot more uncertainty. Really good example here of much higher uncertainty. Another example here, but then there are other heartening examples where there are good trends, where certainly the trend in the components, although they may not sit exactly on the line, the trend seems to be there in terms of the underlying seasonal variation in fractional cover. So it gives us confidence in the product, but not confidence everywhere. And that's the key question, really, is, well, what confidence can we apply to this product? And we've essentially got funding this year to actually do a much more significant quantitative validation of this product. And really the key things in terms of a sort of qualitative evaluation that we've done so far tells us that it's really variations in soil colour and moisture content which affect this fractional cover index. But we also want, we need to know, how much does vegetation structure affect it? If the green vegetation is in a grass versus a green tree, how does that actually affect the estimate of and what if it's in lots and lots of trees, etc. So these are the sorts of things we're looking into with a view to perhaps providing a second version of the algorithm towards the end of this Australian financial year. So in conclusion then, I've bored you for long enough. I think, what I just wanted to conclude really is that this AURA system, this model is perhaps, one of the first products, first models, let's say, which has been developed for water resource accounting, and it's successfully integrating ground and satellite observations. And I've shown you that it's actually can actually reproduce the satellite and on-ground observations highly satisfactorily. The nice thing about this is that really it's been kept quite simple. That it's really taken this notion of sort of model complexity fallacy, that the more complex the model you make a model, the better it will be. It's really not taken that approach. It's really tried to keep it simple and see, well, what are the key components in the system, and let's model it that way. This idea here, more observations do not necessarily reduce uncertainty, much depends on the observational model. And I guess there's further research going on, particularly in this notion around model data fusion. I haven't really presented any conclusions for the fractional cover product, but we've just touched on that. I just thought I'd end with a slide of conclusions from the political sort of sense, really, that a lot of these examples have shown the sort of kind of reliance in Australia on optical data. For obvious reasons, the weather's a hell of a lot better than it is here in Europe, so that there's a greater chance of getting optical, of getting cloud-free, let's say, optical data. But there really is an under-reliance. We don't necessarily utilise particularly synthetic amateur radar to a great degree, certainly not nationally. And I would argue also for water accounting, particularly sort of river level analysis, the sorts of stuff that Philippa Berry's been doing down in Leicester, is really, you know, we could be really using it for modelling, for monitoring stream inflows of volumes, I guess, or water level in streams. And also, perhaps also increasingly with SMOS and then with SMAP later on, sort of moisture monitoring observation satellites, we could be incorporating more of those as well. What kind of frightens me in Australia is that the MODIS seems to be, MODIS and Landsat are it. There's really not much discussion on what you could call succession planning. MODIS, we know, is, I think, it's going to be on its last legs, or the two of them are going to be on their last legs around 2013. I think that's when the funding runs out. NPOS, and I've forgotten what the acronym stands for, is its planned successor, but that's been a kind of disaster between the NOAA and the Department of Defence. Essentially, the two NPOS satellites have now been split, one to each. But it's a very poor replacement for MODIS. MODIS has been a really successful satellite mission, but there is no real component. Similarly with Landsat, again, Landsat's been the focus for the higher resolution vegetation products in Australia, particularly for use by Geoscience Australia and the development of a dynamic land cover map. But there's a huge product gap looming in that kind of resolution data, particularly from the American sense. There is this Landsat data continuity mission plan, but again, it's only a proposal at this stage. And it kind of highlights also that Australia is wholly reliant on getting this data off other countries. It has no space agency. Particularly the enlightened John Howard years pulled the plug on any sort of space initiative. Some of that's been a bit sort of addressed now, but it's certainly not going to lead to a space agency in a hurry. So it doesn't have its own satellite sensors, and yet it's wholly reliant on Earth observation for its information requirements. But it's completely at the mercy of other countries. And typically, most Australians don't expect to pay for that. And Australia really offers the Earth observation community very little in return. There are some fantastic sites for calibration, big salt pans, big deserts, big black lakes, etc. And there are some sort of calibration services that Australia offers, but it's certainly not nationally coordinated. It's done on a sort of fairly ad hoc basis. In a way, you could argue Australia really gets away with murder on a lot of this. Just soaks all the data in and says, thanks, that's great, yeah, we'll use it. And you can see great examples of its use, but it's really at the mercy of, it's been, sponging off the rest of the world. The satellite providing nations like NASA, like the Europeans, like Japanese and Indians, increasingly as well. And I guess going into the future, the Chinese. Okay, those are just a few topics to sort of whet your appetite for discussion too. Cheers, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
So I went for the full lights off this week, but as we're in deepest, darkest winter, it's good to have them on.
You can wake up now.
Yeah. So, questions? Who'd like to go first?
Neil, hi, how are you? Just to start you off with a quick one, today, welcome back. Talk about the problem of micro satellites in Australia, because if it's going to be as lovely as you're showing it, maybe you should get some satellites to build you on.
And yeah, that is the remarkable thing, you know, it just seems to fall on deaf ears. You can go and argue, you know, well, actually it's really cheap to get a satellite, you know, buy a satellite to you know, do the sort of DMZ type approach, you know, which would be really useful, but it really falls on deaf ears, yeah.
Just to follow on from
people
formulating proper questions, do you know that the Australians have been doing a lot of work with this whole projected cover?
Yeah. Well, let's say the Queenslanders.
Okay.
Whether they're Australians or not. Makes some sense. Hope there are no Queenslanders in the room.
Some people are really sort of pushing that, advocating that.
Yeah.
What you're doing with your fractional education cover, quite a different approach. Yours is obviously a bit more scalable.
But it's trees. Fractional projected cover is trees. You surveyed that on the ground, essentially. So I forgot what they use. It's either a laser pointer, pointed vertically, or something else. But basically, is measuring, the point of sort of cover in trees, and huge parts of Queensland are covered in trees, but huge parts of Australia are just shrubs and grass. Yeah.
That's a huge oscillation.
Yeah. It works extremely well. The Queenslanders have done, they are probably, as a state, producing the best, satellite products for their purposes. And probably have the best validation approach to it, and the SLATS technique that you might have heard of. But it's really not something that can be, the SLATS validation method can be rolled out nationally, and is what we're going to use in the validation of the fractional cover product. But it's not, the foliage projected cover is not going to work everywhere. Bob, has a word? Bob.
As a human geographer, I ask this question of trepidation. It may be completely irrelevant, it may be silly, it may be completely off track. But I kind of discerned somewhere that there was some question about whether this big drought in Australia was entirely climatic and that it might be partly anthropogenic.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And can your research say anything about that?
I certainly think, the components that leading into this Murray-Darling sort of basin plan has been a series of studies undertaken by CSIRO on what's called a sustainable yields project. So this has been actually accounting for trying to use river modelling. Again, Landsat-based analysis of river catchments on vegetation cover and presence and management to estimate what actually are the sustainable resources available from every catchment in Australia. But a huge component of that has been the sort of, what has been the human impact on, what has been the result of, human impact on catchments of forest clearing. But it's all tied in, forest, people say, well, we should be greening Australia, but research has also shown that if you actually plant trees, that actually means less water in the streams than it does, the trees essentially are transpiring the water. So it has, if you make, try and reforest Australia, make it greener, it actually means there'll be less water in the rivers for abstraction. And but I think a significant argument around this guide to the plan, this thing that just recently came out, has been that they haven't accounted for the sort of socio-economic impacts of saying, well, there should be greater flows for the river itself, for the environment.
So do you think then that a significant part of the big drought has been anthropogenic?
I'm sure it is. I really can't sort of say definitively because I've only been there a year and a half or whatever. And I'm not Australian. So, but I suspect it is. I suspect it is, yeah.
The humans.
I just kind of adding on to that. One of the things I was wondering, maybe you covered it but I didn't pick up, was in the modelling approach, I guess, A, how important is the anthropogenic signal within the model? Is it modern, and is it possible to disinter those two? Because, like, Grace is clearly picking up anthropogenic and natural.
Yeah.
And at that scale, does it matter, I guess?
Yeah, I don't know. I suspect that there isn't a significant anthropogenic component in there, sort of socioeconomic. It's just simply purely water accounting. So it kind of integrated into the satellite observations.
If there's water in the catchment, it's going to be used, but it's still going to have to pass through the catchment.
I mean, water use, there's a water, you know, you saw there's a water use kind of module, so that's accounting for the abstraction, etc. I can send you a very thick report on it. Or you can learn all about it. Yeah,
it's interesting.
Bruce?
Tim, I can't help but be taken by the scale of Australia compared to Scotland. Karen and I were meeting this afternoon, we were sort of ticking boxes that you all have. Complete material footage coverage of Scotland at 6.25 centimetres, and we'll have your terrain models at 5 metres or better. And that's great. I'd just be interested in your reflections on your experiences here versus your experience in Australia and that sort of data divide, effectively.
I think, you know, I've been kind of blown away. My jaw has dropped on several occasions where, you know, I did a lot of projects, you know, marine mapping on the west coast of on the west coast here, getting, you know, echinoids and creek bird imagery and things like that. And even on the east coast, on the Tay Estuary, you know, it took us two years to get, you know, 3 images that covered the Tay Estuary at low tide, you know. I've been doing a project on Lake Burley Griffin, which is the lake, man-made lake in the middle of Canberra, but has a fantastic bloomering algal blooms. Using WorldView 2 data, which is the kind of successor to the creek bird, and in 6 months, we got 38 cloud-free images. And my jaw just hit the ground. And there are people, you know, in around Alice Springs, who you know, CSIRO scientists there, who are essentially using Landsat, you know, Landsat to tease out the phenological signal. You know, they know that every 18 days when Landsat comes, it's going to be effectively, you know, there's not going to be many clouds in it, you know. And here we're lucky, you know, we get a decent cloud-free Landsat image every 5 years, isn't it? It has been, but it is, and it is the scale, you know, it really is. I was kind of hoping, you know, to go out there, and because I'm really keen on, you know, airborne imaging spectrometry, but really, you know, it's such, because it's so local in Australia, you know, it might cover a very small catchment or a forest or something like that. The questions are so much bigger scale in Australia, and it's so well suited to satellite data. I hope that answered your question. Yeah.
Actually,
that's quite a warm.
Are you saying that getting the country distance and they send us the Netherlands?
Yeah.
Why? Because it seems that they've got good results once they start reviewing it. Plus, we combine them with different sources of information, different models, produce very good results. Why do you think the countries who have water stress haven't used this technique before?
Well, I think the argument is really that, you know, that it's only recently that the kind of technologies have become much mature. There is, I'll give you a copy of it. Albert van Dijk and Luigi have written a paper, which I'm more than happy to pass around. It's only in draft form, it's submitted, but they do talk about in the paper some other examples of modelling, particularly in the US, what's called the Land Data Assimilation System in the US, which is sort of getting there, but it's not entirely, you know, what they would argue is a sort of water resource accounting model. And I guess it's only, you know, when you have a significant water shortage that you know, you're going to get the sort of financial incentive from politicians to actually develop these. And I guess, you know, there's a significant financial incentive in the Netherlands to know where their water is and where it's going.
I was going to ask, do you get hard times at Kiwi and Oz, but I think I'll save that one. I think the weather people are, they usually go to 213, but it looks like they may be wanting in here. So right. I think we'll retire to the library bar, TV it. Obviously, thanks to Demetrius for helping set up the seminar. And if I can grab the volunteers and the students to clear the decks, just let the weather people in. But thanks to everyone for coming. So that's the TV at bar across that library bar across the TV at the Union. If you'd like to join us for more relaxed discussion later on.
Yep, great.
Thank you. Here. Thanks again. Thank you.
Yes. Okay.